This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So we tell you calmly and very sincerely, if you're frightened easily, turn off your radio now.
The outcome of the CAPS pandemic in event 201 was catastrophic. 65 million people died in the first 18 months. The outbreak was small at first and initially seemed controllable, but then it started spreading in densely crowded and impoverished neighborhoods of megacities. From that point on, the spread of the disease was explosive. Within 6 months, cases were occurring in nearly every country. The global economy was in a free fall. The GDP down 11%. Stock markets around the world plummeted between 20 and 40% and headed into a downward cycle of fear and low expectation. Businesses were not borrowing, banks were not lending. Everyone was just hoping to hunker down and weather the storm. Economists say the economic turmoil caused by such a pandemic will last for years, perhaps a decade. The societal impacts, the loss of faith in government, the distrust of news, and the breakdown of social cohesion could last even longer. We have to ask, did this need to be so bad? Are there things we could have done in the 5 to 10 years leading up to the pandemic that would have lessened the catastrophic consequences? We believe the answer is yes. So are we as a global community now finally ready to do the hard work needed to prepare for the next pandemic?
You just heard the results from a simulation pandemic. The multi-million dollar exercise was run by Johns Hopkins University and funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Complete with simulated breaking news, representatives from government and industry participated in panels featuring an outbreak of a coronavirus. It was held in New York City on October 18, 2019, just 2 months before a real coronavirus broke out in Wuhan, China, and spread around the world. There is a growing chance this virus, and public fear of it, could cripple the global economy, bring down large businesses and banks, change politics even further towards totalitarianism, and toss you either into a home quarantine for weeks or into a wait-and-see-who-survives camp. I'm going to tell you what I expect, some good sources for daily updates and tips to prepare. Normally here on Radio EcoShock, I carry interviews with scientists about the developing climate catastrophe. In the second half of this show, I will talk with Dr. Mark England. His new research shows that half the incredible warming in the Arctic is coming from refrigeration chemicals that are now banned by the Montreal Protocol. It is major news about global warming. Plus, rivers are not freezing up as they used to. We find out why that matters from scientist Yao Zhang. We will end with a new song from Eliza Gilkyson from Texas. But first, I am tired of hearing soothing pronouncements by big institutions like the World Health Organization. They kept saying it was safe to fly to China, even as the disease raged. They were slow to call it a pandemic. Financial talking heads don't want us to panic. They don't want us to sell stocks or to divest from retirement plans. Just keep going to work. Just keep shopping. While the cable channels drone on endlessly about far-off elections and Trump kills off justice publicly in the United States, we wait and wait for real news from the real world. Well, here it is. Get ready for a viral shock around the world. I don't want to talk about this. You don't want to hear about it. But we have a duty somehow to recognize reality. My comfortable life with all kinds of cheap labor from across the ocean, all kinds of mechanical energy slaves, and thrilling reality TV every night. My comfortable life does not want to be disturbed. We are fine. Leave us alone. Do not enter this space with strange bad news that could spread here. My friends, we are not alone on this planet. The unseen microworld teems with trillions of living and half-living things that want to express themselves, they want to reproduce, and they want to dominate atop colonies of other cells. Some of those host cells that are to be used are in our bodies, in this case, in our lungs. A predatory pattern, the virus, it cannot reproduce itself except by co-opting reproduction in our cells or the cells of other animals. Predictably, this stew of microcosmic living competitors will evolve into more perfect forms, that is, perfect for them. Disease, as we call it, improves by becoming more transmissible and yet not too deadly to kill off the host before reproducing into more bodies. That's how it works. A slew of microbiologists warned us about this for decades. A few years ago, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation began donating their billions of Microsoft profits into saving lives in the developing world where medical systems are scarce. The foundation went heavily into vaccinations as the way to save the most lives for the least dollars spent. That brought them into contact with microbiologists and disease specialists who warned the risk of a major outbreak was very large and preparation by governments and hospitals was very small. In October 2019, just 2 months before the novel coronavirus appeared, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation created an elaborate, multi-million-dollar game where a coronavirus breaks out into a pandemic. They mounted fake news reports about this outbreak, and it was watched by actual representatives from the insurance industry, travel industry, and many other businesses and governments and medical institutions.
Public health agencies have issued travel advisories, while some countries have banned travel from the worst affected areas. As a result, the travel sector is taking a huge hit. Travel bookings are down 45% and many flights have been canceled. A ripple effect is racing through the service sector. Governments that rely on travel and tourism as a large part of their economies are being hit particularly hard.
The panel discussions were peppered with breaking news about the fast-developing pandemic. They were filmed. You can watch them all at Event 201. Look for Event 201. But be warned, this seems like big industry and government talking to itself, almost in their sleep. They expect corporations to respond and provide for us. Do you? Here is Eric Toner from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation speaking on CNBC on January 24th, 2020.
Most people had never even heard of the coronavirus.
Well, those of us in public health knew about the coronaviruses because we know about SARS, we know about MERS. We've been concerned about them for a long time. We chose a coronavirus for this exercise because of the threat that coronaviruses pose. The point of the exercise, however, was not the number of deaths. It was to point out that there could be societal and economic consequences from a severe pandemic, not just health consequences.
You're not only a doctor, but you specialize in health security, Eric. I'm just curious what you make of the quarantine efforts that have been put in place by Chinese officials and if those will be effective in containing this virus.
Well, this is the largest ever effort to quarantine a city. And I'm afraid I think it's unlikely to be effective. I think that people will have already have escaped the area. There are already cases now in every province of China and in multiple other countries. So I think probably the cat is already out of the bag and these attempts will be unsuccessful.
Doctor, what are you expecting in terms of what we'll see in terms of the virus's spread outside of China? We did hear from the WHO yesterday that we have seen person-to-person spread beyond just that first infection in China. Do you expect we're going to start to see that here in the U.S. and in other countries?
I think we probably will see some degree of human-to-human spread in other countries. The question is how much. But the advantage we have here is that we know about this virus. We're looking for it. We will isolate people who get sick. When it first emerged in China, they didn't know about the virus, and so it spread fairly widely even before they knew what it was.
The game simulation that they mounted was so close to our present reality that some conspiracy sites now blame Bill and Melinda Gates for the current pandemic. They knew, they say. Of course they knew. Anyone listening to warnings coming from the scientific and medical communities knew humanity was horribly exposed to microbial diseases. The public was not aware, but any of us could have found out. But it was technical, and it's not always easy to grasp, and it's really too scary to allow into our lives. Now, here it is. Climate change is just the same. We are trying very hard to ignore that as well. The climate problem is so huge and such a big threat to our mostly pleasant lives here in borrowed fossil time. In January, we heard from Chinese scientist Zheng Zhongzheng that the climate of southern China has changed. It is hotter and wetter there. That affects agriculture and people's lives. It affects the animals. How do those climatic changes affect the microbial world? We do not know. Are animals stressed by changing climate more open to a new disease, one that could transfer to humans? We do not know. Changing the climate of the world changes everything. We do know that mass air travel and global tourism are major factors in the greenhouse gas emissions heating up this planet. If those emissions are reduced, even for a few months, due to this pandemic, that provides a slight period of relief to the atmosphere. Maybe people will get used to a new way of living. As it was, we just reached a new high for carbon dioxide in the atmosphere during the last million years. In February 2020, it was 416 parts per million. It seems like just yesterday CO2 levels passed the 400 parts per million mark. 500 ppm will come quickly enough. But do we need a crash to save us? If the pandemic causes a major market crash and collapse of global trade, and people stay home, our children may have a chance of surviving rapid climate catastrophe. I don't think that will happen this time. I personally would be better off if an economic crash did not happen. My kids would too. But everything that lives in the climate humans have known for the past million years will have a better long-term chance to survive if we do not heat the planet by 3, 4, or 6 degrees centigrade within 100 or 200 years, and that is what we are doing now. A couple of years ago, scientist Tim Garrett from Utah calculated that only a collapse of our current global industrial system could save us from climate catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands more scientists warn we cannot keep dumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Either we have to stop by agreement, or something else has to stop us. Is it invasion by an alien from the micro world? Can the plague slow us down as we rush to mass extinction? We do not know the dual roles of biosafety labs, which are multiplying across the U.S., Europe, and around the world. There is a building spree for them. Research on pathogenic bacteria and the virus are like missiles, which can be used in defense or in offense. Search for this article. Inside the Chinese lab poised to study the world's most dangerous pathogens by David Cyranosky, published February 23, 2017, in the journal Nature. It's about the lab in Wuhan. It's an eye-opener, I think, about an undeclared biological cold war that is ramping up.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We do not really know what the Chinese scientists took away from the Canadian Biosafety Level 4 lab in Winnipeg before they were kicked out in July 2019. The Canadian government recently denied internet rumors of a connection to the coronavirus, and China's first biosafety lab just opened in Wuhan, China, the epicenter of the outbreak. Was there an accident in China's new lab? We will probably never know whether this novel coronavirus crossed from the animal world, as we are always told, or was inadvertently man-made. Remember that even with up to 100 million people dying during World War II, the population actually grew during that time. We could lose 100 million now to the pandemic and keep wrecking the planet. I worry the oligarchs see the advent of robots and artificial intelligence. Are they secretly saying there are too many useless mouths, as Hitler put it? Perhaps there are people thinking of themselves as realists who accept that several billion people are no longer necessary to their wealth. Remember, too, that there are sounds like this. A month ago, I told my family my guess on the possibility of a global pandemic reaching us was about 5%. That is not nothing, but not much. Now, with recent news, I would say 10%. But we can be 100% certain that big business and big bankers are starting to sweat. The 2008 crash is still with us. We barely avoided a global financial meltdown then by pretending to create new money. Since then, governments and households have continued to pile on more and more debt. Nobody planned for a massive withdrawal of workers in a pandemic, or a parts shortage, or stay-at-home consumers. Here is disease specialist Michael Osterholm on NPR's Science Friday, January 31st, 2020.
The case numbers, Ira, that you mentioned and we talk about really represent just a small fragment of the number of cases, in large part because the number of test kits and the availability to access testing in China is extremely limited right now. They're working on that. They're doing everything they can to increase that. But we have estimates now based on our studies from inside of China, one that just came out this morning from the University of Hong Kong, that at least 75 to 100,000 people alone are infected in Wuhan this week. So you can see that this is a very, very dynamic situation, and frankly one that I think the only way I see this going is that the whole world will potentially look like China over the next 6 to 12 months.
The just-in-time factory supplies are no longer leaving the world's workshop in China. Major ports like Shanghai had 100 giant container ships leaving China daily. That has trickled to almost nothing. Be aware that parts are going to run out. Eventually, the global glut could turn into somewhat empty shelves. You or yours may be too sick or too scared to go shopping anyway. Businesses may already be weeks away from closing. From China to America to Europe, governments and central banks are pouring in the money, the emergency funds and promises. Even if this so-called COVID-19 disease somehow miraculously stays mostly in China, your world may never be the same.
The Global Preparedness Monitoring Board is an independent body assembled by the World Health Organization. They indicate that there is a growing risk of a worldwide pandemic that will kill tens of millions of people. This type of pandemic could occur naturally, or it could be a bioweapon that was deliberately created. It could even be accidentally released from a research facility. Managing a disaster of this nature is not as simple as managing a benign threat like a hurricane, a cyber attack, or a direct attack on critical infrastructure. The effects of pandemic are far-reaching and prolonged. The gradual collapse of social systems could last months, even years. For this reason, preparing for the next great global pandemic involves serious planning and a long-term commitment that goes well beyond the 72-hour emergency kit. Factors that are making a pandemic of this magnitude more likely are the following: crowded living conditions in urban areas, the increased amount of research on pathogens, and thus the increased potential for a mistake to be made in one of these laboratories, the growing risk of bioweapons, and a global transportation grid which moves billions of people around the world at faster speeds every year.
There is short-term survival and long-term survival. You need the short-term first, or the long-term never arrives. But keep in mind, most people who get this illness get better without medical care. For some people, it is nothing. For others, just like an awful flu. Somewhere between 1 and 5 out of 100 coronavirus infections kill people. Many, but not all of those, are elderly. It would be foolish not to try to stock up to ride out this illness if it comes. And number one is water. Get some. Get lots. We don't know if the workers who keep the water running, the sewage flowing, and the electricity on will continue to show up. Would you, if it meant acquiring an illness endangering your family? You could live for up to a month without food, but only a few days without water. Store water. Number two is food that will keep and can be eaten without heating or electricity. This might include rice, which can be soaked overnight and eaten without cooking. Peanut butter, honey, cereal, canned fish, any pre-cooked canned food or canned vegetables that can be eaten raw. You could likely buy a few weeks' worth of food for less than $200. Start with a bag of rice, if that is all you can afford today. My friends and I ordered a lot of seeds. These can become sprouts in a week or two, or vegetables to plant next summer in an emergency garden or even in pots on your balcony. In third place is protective gear. The lowest standard are masks that are rated N95. That means they stop at least 95% of germs. Of course, that only works if they fit tight. No beards allowed when the virus comes, including mine. Men, do you have a razor that does not need electricity? In the most serious cases, the mask could be duct taped to your face. The cheaper surgical masks offer practically no protection for you, except they keep your fingers out of your nose and mouth where they shouldn't be during these times. That is a key habit we all must learn. Surgical masks are better than nothing. Good luck finding anything. Most protective gear is made in China. They won't be shipping those out to other countries while their disease rages. In fact, one producer shipped 500,000 N95 masks back to China last week. A few vultures have popped up on Amazon and eBay, advertising masks at 4 times the normal price, and maybe it'll go above that. You could try stores that supply painters and maintenance workers. They use masks at work. I bought mine a year ago to use when the forest fire smoke makes it hard to breathe around here. There is no medicine for COVID-19 at this time. You could have some old standbys ready, like aspirin to control high fever or cough syrup, but some doctors say the fever and cough are the body's defenses at work. Something for diarrhea might help, although that appears in less than 10% of cases. The great fear is pneumonia, which was found in all 41 patients admitted to a Chinese hospital intensive care unit on a single day last January. I'm sure you have heard hand washing is the key. Watch a few doctors show you the best way to wash hands on YouTube. It only works if done completely right.
Countries are reacting in different ways as to how best to manage the overwhelming amounts of dis- and misinformation circulating over the internet. In some cases, limited internet shutdowns are being implemented to quell panic.
How much control of information should there be? And by whom? And how can false information be effectively challenged? And what if that false information is coming from companies or from governments?
The World Health Organization spends too much time warning us about fake news and disinformation, while they downplay the reality on the ground and they hand out their own fake news. Sure, there is InfoWars, the infamous InfoWars, blaming the corona pandemic on dark figures who too often turn out to be Jewish bankers. Others say it was Bill Gates himself. Those net harpies are horrible people who want to sell you gold or guns or expensive vitamins that are sure to protect you from disease. When I wonder what the Russians want me to think, well, there is always the Zero Hedge blog. But there are alternative sources I find really useful. For example, there is Chris Martinson, host of the Peak Prosperity blog and podcast. I notice as Chris posts his updates on COVID-19 daily, about 147,000 people watch it on YouTube within 5 hours or so. That is a higher viewership than MSNBC cable TV gets outside of their primetime shows. Chris thinks the worst will probably happen, but he gives out facts and figures for your assessment. Here's a quick sample from Chris Martinson, recorded February 13, 2020.
More new cases around the world, an R-naught that simply blows our mind, all of which means this is an unstoppable pandemic. Hello, everyone. This is Chris Martinson with your update today for COVID-19. It's February 13th, 2020. So let's get right to it, and we're going to go right to the numbers here. So first up, China had this huge increase in the number of cases, which I'm sure you all heard about, and this was largely due to, they said, a reclassification of what they were going to consider to be a known case. This would include cases that were not tested with a PCR test or something like that to give an absolute genetic confirmation, but the clinical case studies presented so nearly along the lines of what you'd expect to see with this coronavirus contagion that they lumped them in. So you see this huge death count jumped in. I think what's really important to notice here is that the total critical is still a very, very large number and still larger than the total recovered in this case. As well, we saw Japan with a death showing up here in this column. Very sad. We'll get to that in just a minute. Look at the details of that. And as well, we see this here in Singapore. We'll talk more about this right now. Total of 58 cases on the books right now, 15 recovered, and 8 critical. So again, this ratio here of critical to total cases is something we're going to want to take a look at.
But now we're seeing a pandemic in Wuhan spreading across China far worse than we're being told. Chengdu is now on lockdown. It's the sixth largest city in China with 14 million people, and it's located over 1,000 kilometers away from Wuhan. The spread of this virus is not being contained. Beijing is a ghost town, and now Chinese police are seizing suspected carriers and taking them to essentially what are death camps, where there is no medical treatment and no supplies. There's been a massive surge in sulfur dioxide levels across China, suggesting nonstop cremations may be occurring. And an exiled Chinese billionaire is saying the death toll may be as high as 50,000 already.
Another favorite source that I check daily is Dr. John Campbell, a physician from the UK.
And as I mentioned yesterday, I can't quite get over this, but the Chinese government officials have been saying that this is now spread by aerosolization, spread in the air. I really don't want to be alarmist, but there are people in Japan in isolation, in quarantine on the cruise ship, and some are in inside cabins and they're going to depend on circulated air. So that's why I think this is going to be a pandemic, because of its spread in the air. And I mean, the measures the Chinese government have taken have been staggering. They've done amazing things, quite amazing things, and yet still the disease is spreading.
Watch John's videos from early February to understand how this novel coronavirus affects our bodies. That understanding can help you decide whether home treatment is still possible for a sick one, or only intensive care in a hospital can save the person's life. Of course, if a disease hotspot develops in your cities, the hospitals cannot possibly cope, as they did not in Wuhan, China. Dr. Campbell's videos could also help you understand options to treat a loved one at home, possibly without getting the disease yourself. Another good source on YouTube is a doctor broadcasting as MedCram. MedCram. Check that out. Finally, if you want to know about protective equipment, which masks to use, and how to lay away food in case of an extended home quarantine, I like an unlikely source called The Canadian Prepper on YouTube.
It's also a known fact that viruses don't like humid environments. Keeping the humidity in your home between 50 to 60% can reduce the survival of viruses in the air and on surfaces by 30%. Ultraviolet light can also inactivate viruses.
For example, his video, Coronavirus, the numbers no one is talking about, had over 100,000 views when I checked last week. He has over 300,000 subscribers. Check out this video titled, Prepper Lore, 10 Steps to Survive a Global Pandemic. I have done Radio EcoShock shows about preparing for social or economic breakdown. Check out our archive at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
When the real pandemic comes, whether it's next month or a few years from now, we come to that crisis point that Nate Hagans talked about recently on Radio EcoShock. From that flex point, we descend into primitive violence, or a better society, or something we cannot now imagine. When we return, two scientists join us to further explain the slow catastrophe that is climate change. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You will sneak into the radio station, taking the place of the mist, so I can broadcast my genuine mental powers to millions of listeners, befogging their minds until they make me their leader.
Why is the Arctic warming so rapidly, with disappearing sea ice and thawing permafrost? Of course, it is due to increasing greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane, we all know that. But new science shows another unsuspected major cause of Arctic warming, ozone-depleting chemicals. Yes, it's refrigerants like CFCs, and they are still up there, and they're still being illegally produced. That adds a whole new dimension to rapid heating in the Arctic. The surprise comes in a new study by American scientists titled Substantial 20th Century Arctic Warming Caused by Ozone-Depleting Substances. It was published in February 2020 in the journal Nature Climate Change. Dr. Mark R. England is a co-author and our guest on Radio EcoShock from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in California. Mark England, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty good. Now, I may have this wrong, and I think many of our listeners will start from this perspective. Are you saying that an ozone hole over the Arctic is somehow warming it and reducing the sea ice?
No, that's exactly actually what we're not saying. So while many people think of ozone-depleting substances in terms of the ozone hole, which, you know, it's natural to do, it's in the name, we are talking about them really as really powerful greenhouse gases, really nothing to do with ozone. So what we're saying is that these ozone-depleting substances are just behaving kind of like CO2, like a powerful greenhouse gas, and we don't have to think about what's happening to the ozone levels in the stratosphere.
Could you name one of those chemicals and tell us how much more global warming potential it has than carbon dioxide?
So we're normally talking about CFC 11 and CFC 12. There's lots of different types of CFC 11 type chemicals, but they're about something like 20,000 times more radiatively efficient compared to CO2. So even though there's far fewer of them in the atmosphere, they can be really powerful. So when there's an increase, like there has been since 1950 to about 2000, that's the period which they're increasing, it's going to have actually a really large effect on the climate system.
Why do ozone-damaging chemicals accumulate at the poles?
So this is the way that the circulation really works, and we're not saying that they have to occur primarily at the poles, but they occur throughout the atmosphere, and they can cause a substantial amount of global warming. But we find in this study that they have outsized effects in the polar regions due to some of the climate feedbacks occurring there. They're not just accumulating in the poles, they can happen throughout the atmosphere.
According to your model runs, how much cooler would the Arctic have been if humans had not released so many tons of ozone-killing substances from, you know, refrigerators and hairsprays and all that?
So in our runs, the Arctic warms, forced by all types of greenhouse gases, by about 1.5 degrees Celsius. Now, if we fix ozone-depleting substances, as in, let's imagine a counterfactual world where ozone-depleting substances hadn't increased so rapidly and just stayed fixed in the mid-20th century, well, we'd have got about 0.75 degrees Celsius of Arctic warming. So that's saying Arctic warming would have reduced by about 0.75 degrees Celsius if we hadn't have increased these chemicals so rapidly.
That's almost half by my calculations.
Yeah, so that's about half. That's why in the title it says substantial fraction of Arctic warming. Now, that's not to say these are more important than CO2. If you did a similar experiment with CO2, you would reduce Arctic warming by about 90%, something like that, if we look at the radiative forcings. And so you could say, you know, you said 90% and 50%, these things don't add up to 100. Well, that's because over this time period, to the best of our knowledge, there's been like a cooling effect from aerosols. And so because you have some cancellation between, largely between CO2 and aerosols, it can mean that these smaller gases, such as ozone-depleting substances, they can have these really large outsized effects because of that cancellation.
Now, way back in 1975, one of my heroes, V. Ramanathan, published his groundbreaking paper, Greenhouse Effect Due to Chlorofluorocarbons, Climatic Implications. Mark, why did it take another 45 years to realize the big impacts that your team uncovered?
I'm actually not entirely sure. I think we've largely disregarded ozone-depleting substances. And since the Montreal Protocol, where substances like CFCs were heavily regulated, I think we've largely kind of ignored them, even though they've had a very large effect on the climate system. So I think what this paper is trying to do is trying to reframe our thinking and show actually that, you know, over the last 50 years or so, they've had a really large impact. And we're talking about these are purely human-made gases. This is, you know, these are not created naturally. So this is something where we can entirely say that this is due to humans.
And how long do these ozone-depleting substances like CFCs stay active in the atmosphere, and when would you expect their warming impact on the Arctic to become far less significant?
They're long-lasting, which means we started regulating them heavily in the Montreal Protocol in 1987, I think it was. But we had to wait. First, we had to wait for the emissions to slow down, but then there was like a 10-year lag between when the ozone hole started to recover, which was in, I think, roughly about 2000, 2005, because it had to take all this time for the ozone-depleting substances to get into the stratosphere. And that takes some time for it to circulate around the climate system. In terms of when do we think this warming will subside, well, because since the Montreal Protocol, we have been reducing our emissions of CFCs, and we've largely gotten rid of them, apart from recently there has been a spike in emissions, primarily in China, I think. We would expect that actually the Montreal Protocol would have a really big effect in mitigating future climate change because we've reduced the Arctic warming associated with these ozone-depleting substances.
Following criticism from some scientists, I think, your group reworded some claims in the original paper by publishing an addendum in Nature. What were the problems, Mark?
So I don't think there was any criticism of the actual science. It was more of the framing. And so I think we didn't spend enough time talking about it, comparing it to CO2. So I think a lot of the way it's been framed, as it's been picked up in the news, is that, you know, 50% of Arctic warming is caused by ozone-depleting substances, which means, therefore, maybe that CO2 causes 50%, and so CO2 doesn't have a huge impact. We're trying to reframe it and say we're not debating the dominance of the importance of CO2. No, you know, that's not what we're doing here at all. What we're saying is that when there's this cancellation between CO2 and aerosols, these smaller, less abundant gases can have an important effect. And I think that that addendum was to kind of address some worries that people would take the wrong idea from this paper. Nothing was inaccurate about it or anything like that.
Now, is there anything we can do to reduce the impact of ozone-depleting substances that are already up there in the atmosphere?
I'm not the best person to ask about that. I don't have any specialist knowledge about that. I think the best thing we can do is, so many countries are adopting the Kigali Amendment, which is to do with the replacement gases. So when we phased out CFCs, we then started emitting HFCs, which are slightly less bad in terms of potential greenhouse warming, but they can still cause global warming. So we've got rid of these one chemicals, which were bad and they caused the ozone hole, and now we found they've had this important global warming effect. But we've started using HFCs instead. So the Kigali Amendment is about trying to heavily regulate the future use of HFCs, these replacement gases. So I think that's the best thing we can do, is trying to move forward with the Kigali Amendment.
Of course, this makes me wonder if those HFCs will also accumulate in the Arctic and start warming things up there.
You know, I think that would be definitely an area of future study because it's, you know, once we start worrying about these smaller gases that the effects of it can have, you know, I think HFCs would definitely be the next place to look.
Well, right. You're also studying the impacts of declining Antarctic sea ice in recent years, and that isn't widely known. What are you finding?
Yeah, so we're going all the way to the other pole, but that's another area which I'm really excited about. And that is, there's been a lot of interest in the effects of Arctic sea ice loss because, you know, that's been declining rapidly over the last 50 years. But what we find to do with Antarctic sea ice loss, and this is mostly to do with projected Antarctic sea ice loss, because all of the climate models, they project substantial declines in Antarctic sea ice extent. We're finding they can have important global effects, and it can be really important for the Southern Hemisphere eddy-driven jet, and it can have important impacts which reach into the tropics, and you know, has this global warming signal actually associated with it. So I think we're trying to reframe how people think about sea ice loss. And you know, 90% of the community is rightly worried about Arctic sea ice loss, but we're also trying to say that the future Antarctic sea ice loss will also have an important impact on the climate system.
Well, I did talk to a scientist about that this year, and she said that the Antarctic sea ice was actually growing until about 2014 and then went through a much faster, more precipitous decline than happened in the Arctic, but that didn't get much press. A huge amount of Antarctic sea ice was lost. And here's what's puzzling me. I mean, we were talking about the ozone and the ozone hole, and there's been an ozone hole over Antarctica for decades. There has to be lots of ozone-depleting chemicals piled up there over the South Pole. Why have they not stimulated warming similar to what you found in the Arctic, or have they?
Yeah, we weren't looking specifically at the Antarctic for this study, but that's really been an open question for a long time, which has provoked a lot of debate about why hasn't the Antarctic been warming to the same extent that the Arctic has been warming. I'm not sure I have good answers for that. So in climate models, they'll generally give more Arctic warming than Antarctic warming. This is a general feature that seems to be robust across different climate model simulations. In terms of do I think that ozone depleting substances would likely have an effect on the Antarctic, I see no reason why they wouldn't, but I think we definitely need to study that further. And that decline you were talking about, the recent decline in, I think it was 2015, in the Antarctic sea ice extent, yeah, this was a really rapid decline. I think it was about 3 sigma different from the variability of a year-to-year variability of Antarctic sea ice extent. So I think that has piqued people's interest, if you get what I'm saying, about Antarctic sea ice. But whether it's, you know, whether there's going to be a continued decline from 2015, I think it's very hard to say. We'd have to wait a few more years to see if these record lows that have been seen in the Antarctic are going to continue.
When it comes to the dramatic changes in the Arctic, our original topic here about your new paper, what should we in the public take away from your new research?
So I think overall it's a good news story, because this is one area of climate change where we have managed to come together as an international community and regulate these gases in the Montreal Protocol in 1987. And this is an example of where climate regulation will have a significant and positive impact on the climate system. So it will have prevented warming in the future. Another way of saying that is without this Montreal Protocol, the warming in the future would have been even more substantial. So I think it's a really good news story, and I think the climate community, we have a lot more to do on recognizing the benefits of the Montreal Protocol. You know, we've really had one big win in terms of international regulation, and we should be doing more investigations about it to see what the potential benefits of it are.
We have been speaking with Dr. Mark England, a climate scientist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in California. He is co-author of the new paper, Substantial 20th Century Arctic Warming Caused by Ozone-Depleting Substances. You can find links to the paper and much more in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org, and you can find Mark at his website, markrossengland.com. I'm Alex Smith reporting.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
We know glaciers around the world are in retreat. Summer sea ice in the Arctic crashed in 2007 and has never recovered. Now a young scientist reports that river ice is also declining. There are consequences for the human economy, wildlife, and climate change. This is new knowledge. We reached the lead author of the study, The Past and Future of Global River Ice. He is Xiao Yang, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. From Raleigh, North Carolina, Dr. Xiao Yang, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, for having me here.
For centuries, northern humans took the annual freeze-up of the river for granted. Now cities like Ottawa in Canada are seeing less time for their great river skating festival, and some communities in the north use frozen rivers as highways for supplies. Xiao, what has changed about the way rivers freeze in these times of a warming earth?
Actually, a lot of research basically based on in-situ observations of river ice has found that in recent decades, there's a later freeze-up and an earlier break-up of the ice on the rivers due to the warming trend we have. And in the study that we recently published, we used satellite images and had the global coverage, and we find that the river ice conditions over the past 35 years has seen a widely decline globally.
How much has it declined? Do you count it in days, or how do you count it?
The particular satellite images that we're using do not allow us to determine the freeze-up and the breakup dates of the river ice every year. So instead, what we calculate is contrasting the first decade and the last decade in the 35 years and calculate the difference between the two decades. What we find is a monthly 2.5 percentage point decline globally.
As we know, the vast Arctic sea ice used to reflect sunlight back into space like a mirror, cooling the planet. Does the combined area of seasonally frozen rivers add up to much when it comes to regulating the planet's temperature?
I would say compared to other components of the cryosphere, for example, like sea ice, like glaciers or ice sheets, in terms of the surface area, river ice actually doesn't really contribute that much in terms of affecting the albedo of the land surface. But there's research showing that it actually has substantial impact on the local climate. Like in the valley where there's a big river during the breakup, you see substantial temperature increase at the time of the ice breakup. So it definitely has impact on the climate, but probably at a more local and a regional scale.
Why does the ice breakup warm up the valley around it?
Because when you don't have ice cover, then all the heat from the water can directly impact atmosphere and also increase the evaporation from the river, and that'll basically heat up the valley really quickly.
And what are the mechanics of how a frozen surface on the river changes the release of greenhouse gases?
A lot of study has shown that rivers and streams are a net producer of CO2 into the atmosphere. But during the times of ice cover, you basically don't have that. You have a physical barrier between the atmosphere and the water column, which prevents the CO2 escaping to the atmosphere.
So if that CO2 or methane is trapped below the ice, when the ice melts in the spring, when you have the thaw, does that create a kind of greenhouse gas pulse at that time?
This is a really good question. It's kind of out of my expertise. But I would say there's processes that's producing CO2 in the stream that will be affected by ice cover, because ice cover blocks the oxygen that's used to oxidize the organic material to produce the CO2. But that is just part of the process that's producing CO2 in the stream. So I don't really know, like, as an overall net effect, what will that be?
And what does a longer ice-free season on the rivers mean for climate change?
The local effect I mentioned, so there's a potential changes in local temperature, evaporation, and precipitation, and that's from the changes in the ice cover. And also, there's more heat transported by the river to the landscape if we have a longer ice duration. At the same time, if the river experiences more days of ice free during a year, it actually absorbs more heat during the summer and fall when there's no ice cover. So it gets even harder to freeze it in the wintertime.
So is this a positive feedback where less river ice could lead eventually to less river ice?
Yeah, in a sense, yes. In terms of the albedo, so because you have less ice on rivers, because the water is in general darker, it will absorb more heat, and more heat will make the formation of ice on a river harder. So in this kind of like feedback, you'll make it actually a positive feedback, just like the CIS or the land price.
A study from the Alfred Wegener Institute says for the past 70 years, the Danube has almost never frozen over. Historically, people expected to skate on the Danube almost every winter, but now that seldom happens, and something is disappearing from the culture in Central and Eastern Europe. Holland, the same. Did your study include rivers in Europe, and if so, what did you find there?
Yes, our study includes rivers in Europe. We studied rivers, relatively large rivers, rivers greater than 90 meters in terms of width. So what we find is, it's very interesting that you ask this, because Eastern Europe is one of the few locations we find that river ice is expected to decrease a lot. Like, it's kind of like a hotspot in terms of where the river ice decline will happen, both historically and what we predicted for the end of the century.
Many of the scientists that I interview on this program expect to see Earth warm globally by at least 3 degrees, and likely more as the centuries progress. What do you see as the future of river ice as the world warms?
So from our study, we estimated that with 1 degree increase in surface air temperature, we expect to see 6 days less of annual mean ice duration over all the rivers globally. So I guess we expect a 3 degree increase at the end of the century. We're likely to see about more than half a month of decline in mean ice duration for all the rivers globally, because only half the rivers that freezes every year, that basically means that there's more than 1 month of ice duration decrease for the rivers that now have ice cover. So that basically means that for places that we now have about 1 month, a little bit more ice cover every year, we should expect to see no ice cover by the end of the century for those rivers.
That's a big change, say, for the people in Siberia. Are there also rivers that freeze in northern China?
Yes, there's like the Yellow River freeze and also the Songhuajiang River freeze in northeastern China.
In October 2019, the Guardian newspaper reported on a related discovery, not one that you study, but it's kind of related, about rivers flowing from the Arctic glaciers. Journalist Leyland Seco writes, in the turbid, frigid waters roaring from the glaciers of Canada's high Arctic, researchers made a surprising discovery. For decades, the northern rivers secretly pulled carbon dioxide from the atmosphere at a rate faster than the Amazon rainforest. That's astounding. Dr. Zhao Yang, do you understand the mechanics of how that is possible?
I definitely noticed that research, and it's really interesting what they reported. My understanding, I have to say I'm not familiar with the details of the study, but my understanding is that because the river has a lot of sediments, freshly from the glaciers, and those sediments can react to the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere through a process called chemical weathering, which will basically pull down the CO2 into the stream, basically using the stream as a carbon dioxide sink. So I think that's mainly what's happened in the process.
Getting back to your study, do you know if a reduction to the length of time rivers are frozen does affect wildlife, plants, or insect cycles?
In my understanding, yes, it definitely will, because with changes in ice duration, there's changes in the availability of the food and the changes in the habitat that's available for the wildlife that's living by the river and the plants due to the local effects of the river ice to the climate that will potentially affect like when the plants will flowering, when they will have fruit. And a lot of the processes really relies on the local climate that will be affected in terms of the fishes in the river, where like their life cycles coupled with the temperature and ice cover of the nearby river, with the river that they live in, will be heavily impacted if we see changes in the river ice.
And I assume there's nothing cities or countries can do about the time their rivers freeze other than to fight for a reduction in greenhouse gases. But are there things that we could do to adapt to this new factor as the world warms?
Yeah, I think this study and hopefully will bring up people's attention about like why we should care about changes in the river ice. in terms of like how we develop our future plans for like in terms of like protecting the ecosystem or building more sustainable infrastructures that take into account of the changes in river ice. For example, like the transportations in the high Arctic mostly rely on a lot of like freshwater ice, like rivers and that forms on rivers and lakes. With the decrease in duration and the potential decrease in strength in this freshwater ice, people should start thinking about alternative approaches to like construct transportation networks in the high Arctic so that we won't see like disrupt happen in the meantime.
Do you expect more follow-up on this study, and what will you be working on next?
I'm actually working on a project sort of related, but it uses a very similar approach to study lake ice. So I think in the future, I'll be keep working on the freshwater ice, river ice, both river ice and lake ice, to study how that will change in the warming climate.
I'll be looking forward to that lake ice study. I think it could be really worthwhile. I hope you'll give me a heads up when it comes out. From Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina, we've been talking with Dr. Xiao Yang. Find links to the new study, The Past and Future of Global River Ice, at my website, ecoshock.org. Xiao Yang, thank you for sharing your research.
Thank you, Alex, for having me here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. From her new album, 2020, this is Eliza Gilkyson with Sooner or Later.
Just enough water, just enough wine, just enough crumbs, a dollar and a dime, just enough hope to keep us toeing the line. But sooner or later, it all back. Will they keep us separated by the shade of our skin? The dark ones relegated to the bottom of the bin. And woman was created to put out and to give in. And the game is rigged and weighted, so you're never gonna win. But sooner or later, from the floor.